People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. I'm thrilled to be talking about a play that I really have loved for many, many years. That's called Noises Off by Michael Frayn, and it's going to be put on at the Theatre on the Bay from the 27th of August to the 14th of September. And I have to say, I can't wait to see it. Their press release says, get ready for a riotous night at the theatre when the Leyting Alexander Musical Theatre Academy, that's LAMTA, presents Noises Off, the side-splitting farce by Michael Frayn that takes audiences behind the scenes of a hilariously disastrous theatre production, and is directed by the multi-award-winning Chris Weir. And it's a play within a play, actually, presenting a series of comedic mishaps and misunderstandings as a cast attempts to stage a farce with a mix of acting, talent, 2 weeks of rehearsals, and all that can go wrong goes wrong. And for some reason, a plate of sardines that never knows where to be. Well, playing the role, not the actual director, but playing the role of the director, is my guest today, Aidan Scott, an actor from Cape Town, studied theatre and performance at Cape Town, and in his third year he was cast in his first professional production of The Mousetrap, which toured South Africa and New Zealand, and most recently he's completed some 9 months of filming on the Netflix series One Piece, playing the character of Helmeppo. Aidan, welcome, welcome.
Rodney, hi.
It's good to have you here, and especially talking about this play. I've seen it a few times. I've also seen the film, and I love it. It's such a brilliant idea, don't you think? To have the audience sitting there watching the rehearsal, and then I think, if I remember the second half, the whole stage is turned around, and the actual players are playing to the backstage.
That's right, yeah. So you get to see all the madness from behind the scenes, which I don't think you ever get to see in any other theatre production.
You don't.
Any other play, I've never heard of anything like that, so it's very exciting. And a lot of sardines, you are right.
I'm going to ask you about sardines later on. But Aidan, am I right in saying that the actual director that you are playing is a lovely role, and the film had Michael Caine cast in that role.
That's right, Michael Caine.
Yes, and you're doing that, are you?
I'm playing the role of the director, who's actually me, the actor, in a play that is directing a play within a play. So it's all very confusing, but I think I've got it just about right a week before opening.
Okay, well, yes, that's when we're recording this interview.
Yeah, exactly, and Michael Caine paid it fabulously. Yeah, and obviously I'm a little bit younger than what the part is. You know, it's usually kind of given to a 45, 50, 60-year-old. But the really cool thing about this is that the production uses the LAMTA students, who are a great bunch of beautiful, beautiful actors. And so, you know, me being 28, I'm now directing these bunch of 20-year-olds. Yeah, I'm finally playing the old man part. So, woohoo.
Are all the actors from LAMTA?
Yeah, so the whole ensemble are students in their second and third years. And then there's myself and Natalie Robbie, who was in Spring Awakening. She is just a delight to work with. So it's her and I who have come on board.
But it must feel really quite exciting working with young actors on a play like this, which is setting up, in a sense, the whole concept of theatre and acting and directing.
Absolutely. And and it's interesting working, you know, coming in as kind of the professional alongside Natalie, and then going into the first week of rehearsals, and Chris works in a way where he works at an incredible pace and blocks the play, and so we had the entire play in the first week.
My goodness.
Then we come into second week of rehearsals, and these LAMTA students are just on it. They just know they've marked their scripts. They know exactly what to say, when to say it. And Natalie and I are looking at each other like, oh my goodness, we need to step up. So it's been a great joy and a big learning experience. And it's very grateful that we're able to kind of present and program work. You know, it's a straight play. It's a farce.
Mm-hmm.
And when do you get to see that, especially, you know, within the past 10 years in the Cape Town theatre scene? So
exactly.
What an incredible, you know, treat for audiences and actors alike.
Exactly. We're talking about these young actors who are so enthusiastic about the whole thing, and also that they are, in fact, playing wrong, doing incorrect things.
Setting it up.
Yes.
As you said.
That you have to correct as the director.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, the play starts and I'm, as the director, placed in the audience.
That's right.
Which is a little bit, and it happens early in the play, so it's not a spoiler. But I'm kind of sitting there watching in rehearsals and just really trying my very best not to laugh, because they are so funny. And yeah. To be able to act badly on purpose, just a delight to watch.
I was going to say, because they're taught not to do that.
They're taught not to do
that. They are doing exactly what they are not taught to do.
Exactly. No acting, please. But this is all acting. And to see Chris take that on and kind of guide them from a sense of realism into this hamminess is quite a skill. And it's also quite hard to do, you know.
But let's face it, comedy is difficult in the first place, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly. And it's a science. It really is.
That's an interesting way of
putting it. That's how, at least how I see it. I mean, you mentioned that I did The Mousetrap, which was my first professional gig. And there was an actor who I'm sure you know, Malcolm Terry.
Yes,
who's
indeed.
Unfortunately gone. But I learned. He was the funniest man that I've ever experienced in my life. And I didn't know how he did it. And kind of halfway through the run in Cape Town, he started giving me little pointers on how to do things, how to turn at the exact moment, how to cut a laugh, or how to ride the wave of a laugh, or how to set up somebody else's laugh. Wow. And he used to emphasize that farce was all about the setup. You have to set up the big laugh that's coming. So you can't be selfish and take the laugh for yourself. You have to set someone else up. It's like football.
And so these
are things that I kind of took on, and I was so lucky to take on, because farce was a really big thing in South Africa in the 80s, 90s.
With people like Rex Garner,
Greg Mulholland,
and, Malcolm Terry,
Michelle Maxwell.
That's right. And
it feels like this kind of oral education that older actors give on to younger actors. It's so delicate because it can be lost. Mm. And I'm so grateful that I got to at least keep a little bit of that information so that, you know, when I'm, you know, in 10 years' time or now or whenever it is, I'm able to pass on some genuine cold, hard actor science to people to, you know.
I love your use of the word science, which is the second time you've done that, because it is, actually, if you think about it, it is, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this play, it's surgical. There's surgical precision in order to make it funny.
Timing is the big thing in comedy, isn't
it? Big time,
yeah. Aidan, let's take a piece of music. There's more I want to ask you about this production. Mm-hmm. What is your first piece of music?
I thought I'd stir the pot a little bit and have a little bit of influence for the FMR listeners, but then also infuse it with a bit of continental jazz. So I'm going to start off with Malatu Atake and his song Tezeta from Ethiopia. Thank you.
That was music all the way from Ethiopia. What was that called, Aidan?
Tezeta, by an artist called Malatu Astake.
Now, how did you discover that?
Do you know, I picked up a really interesting habit of going into charity shops and just finding records, old LPs, but I didn't have a record player. So I just walked in and bought them for 20 rand here and there, and I was like, well, I don't have anything to play them on. And this was a habit that I had for 2 years until eventually my partner at the time bought me a record player. And so I started listening, and this was one of the records that I found.
What a strange hobby.
I know.
What an interesting hobby.
Yeah.
Because it's really a whole world of discovery then.
Oh my goodness, don't get me started. Yeah. I'm a bit of a fiend when it comes to records now. And this is only something that I've picked up of a year and a half of late, which is, yeah, some beautiful discoveries. Including the third one on my list, which we'll get to.
Okay, but now my guest is Aidan Scott, and he is in the production Noises Off, which opens at the Theatre on the Bay on the 27th of August. And in the role of the director, not the director, but in the role of the director. Actually, just thinking about that, we mentioned Michael Caine in the film version. And I don't know if you'll agree with me, but as great as the film version was, because it had quite a cast.
Oh, yeah.
Carol Burnett.
Mm-hmm. Superman? What was his
name? Yes,
Reeve. Christopher Reeve, yeah.
And that chap John Ritter.
John Ritter.
A host of people. But somehow, as great as the film was, it didn't have the tightness and boxiness, I mean that positively, of the play, because a film opens things out, of course.
Absolutely.
And so seeing it on stage, I think, is the ultimate, the best way to see it. But before we get back to that, I'm going to explore you and your background a little bit, Aidan, because you've been an actor pretty well your professional life. I know you said you're a young man, but you studied acting. What got you into acting is what I'd really like to know.
Oh, yeah, I think I was just really lucky. It was one of the things that I was 6 years old and I went to go watch.
Six?
I was six. Yeah, can you believe it? I was six at one stage. I was six, and my parents took me to Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, yes.
And the opening act of this particular Cirque du Soleil, there was a clown on stage, and he did nothing. He just walked onto stage, had a hula hoop, and swung it around the stage for about 5 minutes, and then he caught it back in his hand again. And I just remember looking at my mom and looking at the clown and being like, hang on a second. Something clicked in my brain when I said, I like this. This is I want to do that. Whatever he's doing, I want to do that. And so my mom signed me up for drama classes and...
So they were at least supportive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a strange kid at school. I was a little bit naughty, would you believe? I know I have the face of an angel.
Not you.
Yes, me. I was a naughty boy. I was a bit of ADHD thrown into the mix. And so I was, you know, not naughty, but I was, you know, I was a young lad. But when I went to drama classes at 4 o'clock after school every day, I was good as gold. And I understood that world of rehearsing, and I understood life was quite confusing to me, and still is. And the only thing that's really made sense to me is what I'm doing now, and so I guess I'm pretty lucky that I get to do it professionally.
And you have done, I mean, your debut was in The Mousetrap. You were talking about that just now.
That's right.
I mean, that is an iconic play anyway, to be in, with its incredibly long run and all the twists and turns. As you said, Malcolm Terry helped you through a lot of that.
Absolutely.
And then you've been on film as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was, so started off, I trained in theater when Jeff Hyland was at University of Cape Town. And it's interesting, I had quite a slow start. I was 19, I was 20 at the time when I did The Mousetrap. And then that finished, and I'd taken time off school because I was like, oh, well, I'm working. This is it. Mm. Life is good.
You're a professional.
I'm a professional, and things are going to go. I'm going to get my next play, and I'm going to be sorted, and I'm going to have lots of money. And turns out that wasn't the case, and it turns out it was a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. Mm. So between the ages of around 20 to 24, you know, I was just kind of – luckily, Cape Town has a really kind of thriving film scene. And so I'd have bit parts here and there in film and – but I wasn't really successful in film. And then COVID struck. And actors do this thing where, at the moment, you self-tape. So especially during COVID, when you couldn't go into a room with a casting director, you'd send through a video of yourself doing a scene. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad this happened, because I'd watch myself in the video and be like, well, that's why I'm not getting hired, because I'm doing way too much on camera. I'm theatrical.
You're overacting.
I'm overacting, you know? And so... from that point, I just kind of toned things down a bit, and it seemed to do the trick, and I've worked a lot in film as well as theatre, which is really, I'm happy that I got the learning experience of watching myself.
But listen, Aidan, you had sort of a dream role, really, because you were Mozart in the play Amadeus, which many people saw. And now that I've said that, they might sort of picture who you are from that play. But that was almost a dream role, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is...
How did you land that? That's quite a thing to land as a very young actor.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's weird how life works. I mean, as I said, I was at UCT with Jeff, and I left UCT because I was cast in something, and I don't think Jeff was very happy about that. And so I left, and then there were 5 years of not working, and then 5 years later, I did A Midsummer Night's Dream with Jeff. He hired me. It, you know, how ironic is that? Five years later, he ended up hiring me.
Was that down at Maynardville?
That was Maynardville. That was the kind of reopening of Maynardville after COVID. And then from that, Alan had approached Jeff to direct Amadeus, which is a beautiful play, Peter Schaffer. And obviously, you've got to cast the part of Mozart.
Yes.
And
quite important.
Quite important, right? Yeah. And Jeff Hyland has an incredible ability to see through the eyes of his actors. And I don't know how he does it, because you can have two people that are auditioning for a part, and the one might do it perfectly. But Jeff sees this thing in someone where he sees kind of an untapped potential that even themselves are not able to see. And so somehow he just sent me a message and said, would you like to audition? And so I did, and I got the part, and happily ever after. And it was just an incredible, incredible experience.
It was. And it's such a play as well. And how was it playing opposite Alan Committee? Because he was Salieri.
He was Salieri. And he is now one of my really close friends. And again, one of those people that you can learn from as a young actor. You kind of learn... You learn skills as opposed to, you can't learn talent. Mm-hmm. Also, I don't believe in talent per se, but you can learn skills. And Alan is extremely skilled at what he does. And just, yeah, we had incredible chemistry on stage. And yeah, I'm just really grateful for that entire experience. I mean, what a delight to be able to do a play like that, you know, which is usually a play of 20 people. And we narrowed it down to 8 people.
Yes, I remember that. Yet it worked.
And it worked. Up to Jeff Hyland.
And then, of course, I must ask you, did you know Mozart before that? Sorry, I don't mean that to sound patronizing.
No, not at all. I knew Mozart, but I've never, probably to the level of what, I mean, you don't learn about Mozart in school, right?
No, you don't.
So I probably had just a layman's terms of who Mozart was, and I hadn't seen the film, but I read the script. And I just thought, what a fascinating version of who this guy may or may not have been. And weirdly enough, what I do have of his is a journal actually written by Mozart, where he would write to his wife and to his mum. And in that journal, you can actually see him making fart jokes.
I know.
He was terrible.
And he swore a lot, too.
And he swore a lot.
In those journals.
Yeah, he did.
He used very naughty language.
I know. And not many people know that side of him. So I'm glad I got to know that side of him.
Yes, yeah. It probably added to your interpretation. I'm suggesting that you swore all the time, but it gave a naughtiness to your performance.
Absolutely,
that was good.
Yeah,
we're going to take another piece of music now, Aidan. What have you got for us to deal with this time?
The next one is a British pianist, goes by the name The Vernon Spring, and his song is Mother's Love. Thank you.
More music selected by my guest here on People of Note, the actor Aidan Scott. What was that, Aidan? What have we just heard?
That was a contemporary, I'd call it kind of new age jazz, but he's got a softness to him. And he goes under the name The Vernon Spring, a British artist, and that was his song, Mother's Love.
Okay. You say it in a rather strange way.
It's a strange piece of music, and he's a strange... But I like strangeness, I guess. I'm a big fan of jazz. I was a trumpeter when I was a kid, so I love jazz. There is something about taking the spirit of jazz and placing it in, you know, in the 2020s that I just find very fascinating. So he was one of the people that I like following.
So music is a part of your life in many
ways. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm not a classic musician. I didn't study music, but... I was very thankful to my mum at the same time she started me with drama classes. She said, well, you need to learn to play a trumpet. She said, walk into the shop and tell me what instrument you like. And I gravitated
very
towards
good of your mother.
She was very, very good. Yeah. And so I gravitated towards the horn section and I thought, okay, well, trombone or trumpet? And I was a big fan of Dizzy Gillespie at the time. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, and I was like, okay, well, trumpet it's going to be. And so I played that for a little bit. And somehow that language is just embedded just when I was a young child, it kind of, my brain took to it like a sponge. And so even in the work that I do as an actor now and as a director, music is a huge part in how I work, especially with words. I mean, words are music, you know.
Exactly. What a wonderful thing to say.
Yeah.
So I shall say hear, hear. Aidan, you mentioned the word directing there. And recently, was it last year, you did your first directorial debut?
That's right.
And tell me about that and how it came about.
So that was The Dumbwaiter, Harold Pinter.
For which you've won hundreds of awards.
Oh, no. Yeah, I did. I was very lucky that I got to do that. There was something about that play. So that was last year, May, at the Baxter. I was very nervous. But luckily, I had a good, you know, good pair of actors and now very, very good friends. The first half of the play, absolutely nothing happens.
Really?
Right, which is so counter to what we're used to. We're used to narrative and to stories unfolding. And
but knowing Harold Pinter, he'd always have a strange take on things.
Absolutely, and that was quite scary. How do I direct nothing? And so I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And so I did it and gathered a bunch of sailors to hop onto stage, and we did it. And now they've just opened last week in Johannesburg at Theatre on the Square.
The
same production, yeah. Daphne Kuhn, who's the artistic director, invited us over, and so they're running. This is their final week, and it's going swimmingly.
But now directing is not going to take you away from acting, I hope.
I don't know, Rodney. There's something... Can't one do both? I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
I would say surely you can do both, surely.
Look at Alan.
Alan Committee.
Exactly. I think there are a lot of directors that do that. I've got a deep love for both of them, so I just need to see how my life, you know, who's going to hire me for what, I guess,
yes,
is the ultimate decider of that question.
But you've done amazing things. For example, you were at the Edinburgh Fringe, weren't you?
So I wasn't at the Fringe. I was just after the Fringe.
But I
was in Edinburgh, and that was for a experimental play that was called Don't Make Tea. It was the first time I'd ever worked in the UK, and it was a lovely company. It was a disabled-led theatre company. And it was all about kind of accessibility, particularly with the kind of the government's kind of take on accessibility and how they grant disabled people grants and things like that. And it had embedded accessibility within the play, which I thought was very clever. Also something that I think South Africa is lacking and I feel quite strongly about. I mean, just something as simple as surtitling your performances with just a little, you know, closed captions above the screen so that people who aren't able to hear can hear I think if you create work, I think everybody should be able to watch it.
That's a very interesting take. I'd almost want to expand on that because we used to surtitles in opera because it's the language.
Really?
Well, if it's an Italian or German
opera, you have the translation.
They have the translation up at the top.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
You mean you don't go to opera?
No. Oh, I never said that. No, but yeah.
No, they do. And it's very important. Obviously, there you're dealing with a foreign language, Italian or German or whatever, French. But why not in English? Because very often, if you are hard of hearing and the dialogue is going quickly, it is difficult to keep up.
Yeah, I think if you have budget to be able to, you know, pay actors, pay for a set and pay for a play, I think the least you could do is also just kind of embed accessibility within the story. That's something that I'm very interested in, and the kind of accessibility of theatre is something that I'm interested in, especially in a country where we have 11 official languages. You know, if you have a Zulu show, you know, have English captions. If you have an English show, have Afrikaans and Zulu, whatever it may be, you know.
So you're saying that if it's an English play, you won't have English titles?
Well, you could. It would have to be a choice, wouldn't it?
It would be a choice.
You could have both. You could have English for an English and Zulu for, you know. But yeah, I think the point is the accessibility is for both people that can't or are hard of hearing, and for different languages as well. I think South Africa is unique in that regard.
Is there any other aspect of, what do you call it, immersive?
Embedded accessibility.
Embedded accessibility that you might explore? Because I love this idea of surtitles.
Right. Well, I mean, they did some fascinating stuff, obviously, because they're on the kind of forefront of thinking about accessibility. But within the story, they had a Siri device. Google, you talk to it and it talks back to you.
That's right.
So they had a Siri robot on the table that was played by an actor backstage that would then reply to the characters on stage as a character. But by virtue of doing that, you're also including people in the audience. You describe everything that's happening on stage as a character. And I just thought that. So I think there are really clever ways to kind of make accessibility a part of the story. Mm-hmm. You know?
Very interesting, very interesting. We've come to another piece of music now. There's so much more I want to ask you. We must go back to talking about noises off in a moment. But what is your third piece of music for us?
This is a very special band. They started in the 70s. They're called the Beaters. They started in Soweto. Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse was the drummer. It was his first band. And this is their song Harare, which was a national treasure and did very, very well. And I think it's an exciting piece of music.
Oyo Harare, Harare.
Now, that song was called Harari. The group was called The Beaters. And I must confess to not having heard of The Beaters. You will forgive me, Aidan, for saying that. Aidan Scott chose that. He's my guest this week. And you say that became quite a hit.
It became quite a hit, yeah. As I said, it was Sipho Hotstix Mabuse on the drums, and this was his first band when he came out of Matric in Soweto. And, you know, it was kind of this underground. It started off really small, but eventually they started playing music, and people would gather in the townships and listen to this music. And eventually this particular song got so famous that they changed their name from The Beaters to Harari.
Oh, really?
Which is so they had a name change, yeah.
Okay. Because of that track.
Because of that track, yeah, absolutely.
Aidan, going back just briefly to your career, mm-hmm. and also to Noises Off, when I said just now, would you go to directing, and you said quite rightly, can you not do both? Mm-hmm. And any other aspects of theatre? For example, tell me with this Noises Off about the set, because it's a character in a sense, the set, isn't it?
Absolutely. We have... it's so interesting the way that Chris is direct. Okay, let me start off with the set. The set is grand. It rotates, mm-hmm. and it is a living room. So the set within the set is a living room. And then in the second act, it completely does a 180, and you see the entire set from the back.
Yes.
That's where all the kind of madness unfolds. I think there are 6 doors that are used. Now, obviously, in farce, your timing is so particular that your line might come after a single door slam. Or when you hear a door slam, you've got to come out of yours, and then the person upstairs also comes out of theirs.
Gosh.
And so how do you start kind of grafting that in as a director? Now, Chris Weir, who's, in my opinion, a bit of a genius, says that whenever you walk off stage and through a door, you have to say, click, bang. Click, open, bang, closed. So now if you come and watch a rehearsal, you have all these actors going click, bang, click, bang, click, bang. And you're just like, what is happening? Now
it won't be in the performance.
Well, this is what we're hoping. We're hoping that it doesn't stick to the lines. But but it's a really good way because it becomes a part of the timing. And obviously, you know, with farce, sometimes you're on stage and you have to listen to someone walking up the stairs and count. OK, they're walking up the stairs. 1, 2, 3. And here's my line. And it's so particular. It's a great joy to do a farce in 2025 because I don't actually remember the last farce that was in Cape Town. It might have been Noises Off or maybe The Play That Goes Wrong.
Because that's another great theatre piece, isn't
it? Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it funny how we, the audiences, love to see things going wrong?
Oh, we love
it. I mean,
we
love to see a proper play and all the joy and stimulation that brings. Mm. But it's like corpsing on stage. People love watching actor's corpse starting to laugh. So seeing this play Noises Off, especially act 2, where things do start going wrong, is somehow hugely entertaining, as was The Play That Goes Wrong.
I think audiences like, we know that these are actors on stage, and so when things do go wrong and an actor starts to corpse, what a delight to see someone, you know, being a human and knowing that, oh, wait, this is just a performance. And then that reassures and kind of solidifies the fact that these guys on stage are doing such difficult and kind of challenging work to bring this entertainment to us, that when they do corpse, we realize how easy it is for things to actually go wrong.
Right, indeed. You know? And you were going to tell me, Aidan, about the set.
Oh, so
you said about the doors.
So we have the doors, and the way Kieran McGregor is our designer, who's I think a very, very talented young designer. And Chris has kept the language, obviously, it's not an adaptation, so the language is right as it was in the 60s. But there's a slight contemporary flair to it where the living room is, it's not old and dreary. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of like a, what's that shop called? Wayland's? Wayland's, the kind of interior design with the beautiful white walls and lovely slick couches. And I think that's exciting. I think it's exciting to see this work in a kind of contemporary setting.
Yeah. And you, as the director, the actor-director, opposed to Chris Weir's directing, if I remember correctly, in the second act, you don't appear at the beginning, do you? You kind of pop in, don't you, to see a production and realize just how wrong it's all gone.
That's right. I think my first stage direction in Act 2 is, Lloyd, the director, enters in like a whirlwind. And I've been practicing my whirlwind for quite some time, and I think I've nailed it.
Okay.
And I'm just backstage watching this madness unfold.
Okay, so you are backstage. We do see you.
Absolutely, yeah. Just the right time.
Mm-hmm. You know, earlier we were talking about the students from Lambda, the young actors and actresses taking part. What a wonderful learning curve it must be, especially when you start talking about door slamming and counting and the fine timing in comedy. That must be a joy and a challenge, gosh.
Yeah, it's a joy and a challenge. And I think it's so... What's exciting to me about that is that it feels like we're bringing back the craft of acting to South Africa, which I think is so vital. And, you know, it's not just kind of, you're not just doing it for fun. There's dedication, there's a precision, there's a craft that comes with performance, and it can only be learned. And what better hands to learn from other than the guidance of someone like Chris with a play like this?
Noises off.
And it's exciting because it means that, you know, as I age and, you know, I want to do this for a very, very long time, it means that when I'm, you know, 60 years old and there's a play that I want to do, it means that we have a pool of actors that are dedicated and that have a professionalism and a craft that are able to robustly bring theatre to the public as trained professionals that don't do musicals, that do straight plays, which I think people enjoy because I know I do and I know a lot of people do. And it's just exciting that they have the opportunity to be able to learn with someone like Chris. I just think it's very, very exciting and vital.
I think now let's have another piece of music, Aidan. What have you got for us this time?
This is a wild card. This is a wild card.
Hold on to your socks.
It's jazz. It is jazz. It's new age jazz. It kind of starts, there's an electronic piece in the beginning, but then it goes to these beautiful horns that just blare kind of halfway through. And I think it's a very, very exciting piece of music and very soul-y and bluesy. It's by an artist called Romar, and the song is called Hey Now, When I Give You All My Lovin'.
Another choice of my guest, Aidan Scott. What was that now, Aidan? What have we just heard?
That was by, in actual fact, and you might not like this, but it was by a DJ called Romar, who decided to add a solely jazz horn section to one of his songs, and I just thought it was a really fun piece of music. The song is called Hey Now, When I Give You All My Lovin'.
Do you listen to music when you're relaxing, when you're away from the stage and, you know, you've finished your rehearsals, the show is running? Does music do something for you?
It does, but I'm quite funny with music. You know when you see people walking around with earphones and headphones? You know, then I like being alone with my thoughts. So when I do listen to music, it's quite active. And I think that's also why I gravitated towards LPs and records, because it means that I can sit down, put what I want to listen to on kind of consciously and with meaning, and listen to the album for what it is, and then take that off and be like, I listened to the entire album.
Yes.
And so for me, it does help me relax.
For me, who I love music, obviously, it's a bewildering thing, this whole Spotify. You know that all music is available
at any point,
at a click, anywhere in your life, anywhere you are.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I find that slightly irritating and confusing, because I like to make up my mind, I want to listen to this.
Absolutely.
And put in the old CD.
Yep.
And listen to it.
And listen to the whole album.
The whole album.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Otherwise, there's too much.
Are we old-fashioned?
No, not at all. Come on. They need to get with it.
Aidan, before we run out of time, I threatened to do this, and they keep going on about a tin of sardines in this wretched play. What is that all about? A tin of sardines of all things.
It's our first piece of drama that you get introduced to within the play. And I love that the playwright just decided to add the most obscure food into this and just create the most amount of drama around a fish.
Yes.
So when you come to watch, the sardines pop up here and there, they get lost and forgotten, they get left on stage, and it feels like the main point of drama are the sardines.
So keep a close look.
Keep a close look.
A tin of sardines.
All the time.
Aidan, do you enjoy all sorts of theatre? I mean, Amadeus, for example, was really rather serious, intense theatre. This is a farce, as you say. Mm-hmm. Is there a favourite you have, or do you just enjoy doing everything you can lay your hands on at the moment?
I mean, truthfully, everything that I can lay my hands on. Mm. I don't think I'm kind of pulled to a genre, per se. I'm drawn to words, and I think if a script is written well, regardless of the genre it's in, that's what interests me. It's the way that a story is constructed. It can be any genre. And I do find all types of theatre interesting, as do I with musical theatre, if the script is there and is exciting. You know?
You preempted a question, Martin, because I was going to say, do you ever do musical theatre?
I've never done musical theatre.
Would you like to?
I mean, I can hold a note. I mean, there are some parts of musical theatre that I think are very exciting. What was the one in Matilda, the dad? I think it's such a... And Trunchbull as well in Matilda. I think there are some great parts for actors and musicals, and I think that would be a big challenge for me, but I'd love to do something like that one day.
Have you had any voice training in regards to singing?
Not to singing, but obviously as an actor, you go through kind of... And very importantly, which I think they should bring back into schools, very in-depth voice training. Because that's the first thing an audience hears. And acting, in my opinion, this is a theory, and you can quote me on this, but the most important thing in acting is your voice. Number one.
We actually were discussing voices just when we were settling down in the studio, weren't we? And both of us agreed how important voices are. In radio, of course, it's all about the voice because there's no visual. And do you use your voice anywhere else? Or do you do things like voiceovers or anything like that?
During COVID, when there wasn't much acting work, I kind of set up a freelance. I had a little microphone in the cupboard, and I did, you know, freelance voiceover work. But it's definitely something that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of that, I became very kind of involved with sound production and cutting and how to master. And I find it all, it's very exciting.
It is very exciting.
Yeah, it is. It is. I feel like a bit of a nerd, but I love it.
And the other thing, apparently, you can do accents, which I know is a gift some people can. I absolutely can't. I cannot use another voice at all. And it amazes me when people can do accents and change their personality completely just with their voice.
Who, me? I can't do accents at all. You kidding me?
Sorry, that's an easy one.
I know. What do you want to hear?
Well, I don't know. Something more exotic.
Exotic? Oh, no. Exotic. I might get cancelled. Let's not do that.
Okay. Where did I see that you... you produced... Leonard DiCaprio had something in your life, didn't he? In that show you did Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's right. I played a young Theodore Roosevelt, which was very, very exciting. It was produced by DiCaprio's production company called The Appian Way. I was 24 years old, and I was very nervous, and I had lamb chops. But, you know, that exists forever on screen for anyone to see at any point.
Well, exactly. Your lamb chops.
My lamb chops.
Aidan, we're going to have to leave it now, but it's been so infectious hearing your enthusiasm, not only about this play, Noises Off, but about your art, your craft, words, some of the things you said have been very important.
Thank you.
So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me.
And just a reminder that Noises Off runs from the 27th of August to the 14th of September at Theatre on the Bay. And I can guarantee you a great evening out at the theatre like you haven't had before. As you know, I'm a huge fan. Aidan, before I let you go, what's your last piece? What are you going to leave us with?
My last piece is, I think, maybe my favorite song. It's by an artist called Alabaster de Plume, which is a very funny name. His song, he started off as a jazz musician, classically trained, but now has kind of gone again into a kind of new age version of what jazz is. And you get to hear his beautiful voice in his song, Is It Enough?
Well, I'm not suggesting we've had enough of you, Aidan, but it's been a joy chatting to you. Aidan Scott, all the best.
Thank you, Rodney. Thanks for having me.
Call me a coward, I am. Paint me a line like I can. I taste your body in mine. But I'm my brother, time I spend, I believe, 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 I believe if you pretend. Is it enough? The crime, is it enough? The boogie, the bottle, the bad times, is it enough? I am man on man, the monster plan, is it enough? The crash, the cracking, the theft, the walls, the waste, the well wishes and the race hate, is it enough?
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.